The following is Lyle Kantrovic, Lou Rosenfeld, Dean Barker, and Samantha Bailey's panel, The Secrets of Master UX Consultants from the 2015 Information Architecture Summit.
All right, good morning. Can you guys hear me in the back? Back there? All right. My name is Lyle Kantrovic. I want to tell you a little bit first about how this idea for this panel came up. So I've had a lot of folks that have asked me about consulting over the years, people who are starting consulting, thinking about consulting, maybe people who have been doing it for a little while and having some struggles. And so they'll ask for thoughts and advice. And so I just was thinking about this topic and how do we help others who are kind of in that mode. And I remember from college that in speech I learned that a good presentation always involved visual aids. So I have visual aids and props. So I brought my props with me, and that's what this is about. So I thought I got to get some smarter people. So these are the smartest people who are available for this time slot, who've done some consulting. So we're going to talk a little bit about the secrets of master UX consultants. Our panelists are Dean Barker, wave, Samantha Bailey, and Lou Rosenfeld. So just a little bit about our panelists. Dean's done a lot of consulting over the years. He plays a mean like 15 instruments, I guess. And currently he's working at Optum, leading a pretty large team of internal consultants. I've worked with him as an external consultant. He's run his own consultancy. So he brings a lot of experience to the panel. Lou, I don't know, he's done a couple things. Started the first IA consultancy, I believe the first one. Definitely one of the most renowned. He's a consultant independently. He knows a lot about polar bear behavior, I guess. He's a hit with geeks around the world. And Samantha has also done a lot of consulting both internally and externally. And has been at Wachovia, Thompson, and she's currently now at Merrill Corporation. So we're going to talk about some different questions. I've done a little consulting myself, so that's a slide about me. I currently run a small consultancy, but I've also been internal and worked at a larger consultancy externally. So before we get into the questions for the panel, I want to do a little poll of the audience. So for a show of hands, how many of you would call yourselves an internal consultant? Okay. How many of you would call yourself an external consultant? Some of you did it twice already. And how many of you are thinking about being a consultant? A few of you, okay. How many of you hire consultants? Okay, can you guys all put like a post-it note on? You're the prospects in the group. Everybody else will hit you up for work later. How many of you hate consultants? Great. And how many of you hate polls? Okay, so we're going to start off with just some questions. If you've got questions along the way, if you disagree in a major way with something they've said, feel free to pop up and we'll get a mic to you. We want to make this interactive. So I'm going to start with the question of, beyond technical or UX or IA skills, what skills are most critical for being a successful consultant? We'll start with Samantha.
Ultimately, I really feel like there's kind of a hustle factor that's most important for being a successful consultant. And I don't mean that in a derogatory way, but just you have to be willing to put yourself out there, be willing to face rejection. You have to kind of look for opportunities and figure out how to oftentimes wedge a foot in the door and guide people along to help them figure out what they want to pay you, hopefully significant amounts of money to do.
Hustle.
Oh, no.
Not hostile.
Hostile is not recommended. Okay. Yeah. Well, and when we were talking about it earlier, I was feeling like, oh, hustle seems a little, I'm not sure that's a good word to use. And I was saying, well, maybe it just really is networking. And that's a component to it, but I think it's networking plus the willingness to put yourself out there.
What's the opposite of hustle? What do people go into the consulting and they don't have the hustle factor? What does that look like?
Hungry?
Yeah. There's a question back here, Gigi.
So if you don't think you have the hustle factor, like
maybe you weren't born, a hustler. Like, okay, my cousin was born a hustler. He was like,
right.
He had that lemonade stand and he was like selling things to his friends and whatever. I'm not like that, mm-hmm. but I would like to be able to compete with those kind of people.
Right.
Is it possible or should I just?
I think yes and no, because I'm not a natural, instinctive kind of hustle person. I am very good at finding people who have hustle and drafting off of them effectively.
Lou, did you have something to say to that?
Yes. You know, when you asked the question, I was thinking of channeling my inner Montero and talking about, you know, you have to be able to tell people to fuck off and, you know, you have to be able to walk away from deals and yada, yada, yada. I don't know, though, that we should be looking at hustle or no hustle, that everything fits on like a single spectrum. I think one of the things that we don't often hear about is just having enthusiasm. Enthusiasm is not hustle, and it's not hustle. Enthusiasm is just enjoying the work, which I think pretty much everyone in this room already does. And you give yourself a great disservice if you don't consider that enthusiasm as something that A, has value, and B, has value even more when you frickin' share it. So that enthusiasm that you have for the work, whether you're building a team internally, whether you're working with potential clients, whomever you are collaborating with, that enthusiasm is going to get you a long distance forward.
I would say, too, if you feel like you don't have the hustle, think about starting internally. Learn the rest of the gig so that that's the one thing you need to work on. And also don't quit your day job and go independent unless you've got work lined up. It's just risk management. Yeah. Dean, what do you think on skills for a consultant?
Yeah, so when we looked at this in advance of the panel, the first thing that jumped out at me was just general communication skills. And it seems simplistic, but I remember when I started at CompuWare years ago, there was a manager who said to me, we draft talent on the basis largely of soft skills. So you have to be able to speak, you have to be able to write, you have to be able to put together presentations. We can teach you the technical stuff. We can teach you to do usability testing. We can teach you about computers. We're not really in the position or set up to teach people how to communicate effectively. And that's always sort of stuck with me and resonated with me as I've developed talent and recruited and built teams over. So I really think that that's one critical success factor. And another one is, it's kind of related to hustle, and it's a kind of drive and enthusiasm for learning, for always developing yourself professionally. Look, our field is such a big tent. It's so interdisciplinary that you could have 7 careers and never learn everything there is to learn. Plus, it's dynamic and it's always changing. We were talking a little bit earlier this morning about some mobile stuff, and you know that's really rapidly changing things. And we're struggling a little bit to adapt to that. I've got somebody who's evolving a specialization in accessibility. It's not a strength of mine. I know enough about it to be dangerous. So we're really cultivating that person, and he's really got the enthusiasm for that as a specialty. And so all the people that work on my team are dedicated to lifelong learning, and those that really excel at that are some of the people who excel in general in their jobs.
I have one other thought I want to add to that, is that my whole career, but particularly in my consulting work, I have had a firm rule with myself of never saying no. So, you know, whenever I have been given an opportunity to do something new, to learn something new, to put myself out there, no matter how terrified I have been, and I have frequently been almost paralyzed with terror, that I just have not been willing to say no. And so that sort of never say no mindset, similarly to enthusiasm, will get you very far.
Just to piggyback on that, we sort of have a rule internally when we come across opportunities, and it scares my guys to death, but I always say yes, and then we'll figure out how we're going to do it afterwards. And you know, yeah, sometimes that'll bite you, but what we find is you can become an instant expert in any number of things, and there are a lot of transferable skills that we have in this field in our kinds of positions, kind of related to that crossover presentation earlier this morning.
But do keep in mind that no does mean no. Just no confusion on that, right?
So can I add another angle here, which is the nature of the work we're doing. And you're talking about what it means to be a good consultant. And I think one of the things that we often forget is that consulting is not the same as contracting. And contracting is not the same as consulting. In fact, I want to do something just like, I don't know what to do here.
I feel like it's just something nobody gets. We say we get it, and yet we don't.
Sorry about not hearing you drink there.
You know, so what is the difference? Consulting is when people ask you to help them, but they respect your opinion, and you tell them what to do. Contracting is when people ask you to help them, and they tell you what to do. I feel like a lot of us are still in the mode of thinking of ourselves as contractors. And that means we're not calling the shots in the work. That means we're not taking enough money for the work that we do. That means we're in a kind of submissive position that we really shouldn't be in. And you can pull this apart. There's all kinds of cultural and historical factors about why we don't always stick up for ourselves like we should in this field. We don't need to get into that today. But I will say, every time, and you will bear me out, I believe, that we raised our prices and we actually said no to things, back when we worked together at Argus in the late 90s, every time we raised our rates, we got nervous, but life got better. The work got better. Everything about what we did got better. And it was because every time we raised our prices, people stopped seeing us as HTML monkeys that they would tell us what to do and would start seeing us as people with value. As we started to peg our rates to those of lawyers and doctors and accountants instead of low-level technical and clerical people, life got better. You know there's a lot of demand for what we do out here. So if you're feeling unsure, maybe this is the time to raise your prices and see what happens and see life change for you. It's about being a consultant and not being a contractor. And I'm not going to stamp again. Hopefully I made my point.
Yeah, and I'll kind of we'll take the con.
I got it.
So we do hire a lot of contractors more than we do consultants. I think it's noble to provide that service, but you need to know where you stand. You have to have a very clear mental model about what you're providing and how you're providing it. Maybe there's a certain transformation from contracting to consulting as you go through your career, because you need certain experiences before you can be a consultant at a certain level. But I'll just speak from the point of view of running a large internal UX group and needing to hire people. We do need good contractors on a consistent basis, and they're hard to find, and you know the rates are pretty good. And so there's definitely work there. Samantha mentioned the whole thing about being hungry. It's okay to take some of those wireframing jobs if it's the difference between being hungry and not.
And you could be contracted externally as a contractor to work internally as a consultant.
But don't you feel that if someone starts as a contractor, that sort of sets the mold for their career with that organization, that it's hard to necessarily move into a consulting role?
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. I think in that organization for that period of time, I think to take those skills and leverage them and take that experience to something bigger, if you will, and you're going to be kind of pegged in that organization. But I remember, I'll go back a number of years ago, I had a contract at American Express, and it spanned a time when I was working for Compuware, and then they folded the UX group, which you'll find happens from time to time. Then I went independent, and I opened my own firm, and I had a contract with American Express that spanned that period. So I was with them for 4 years on a half-time basis, and it was wonderful because, particularly as a soloist, it gave me that financial foundation, so I had 20 hours a week that I was billing that I could then go look for other work, do other projects, and that was very much a contractor engagement, but it was a lifesaver from a financial position. How did I do consulting with them? No, not so much, but it was the basis for other true consulting.
Okay, so I'm going to change the topic here. So successful consultants have to be able to sell their services or their company's services. What's the secret to winning a proposal? Lou?
I'll be a little probably contrary here and say that the secret is not to write proposals or responses to proposals. I think that many consultants, if they see an RFP, that something's gone wrong. They're really not the right people to be receiving RFPs. you should not really be writing proposals. You should be having conversations that lead to maybe writing contracts or agreements that are short and are basically saying, yes, we're going to go ahead on an engagement together. But if you're responding to an RFP, typically it's a horribly written effort on the part of a client to solve the problem, which is ultimately what a consultant is supposed to do for them. So I just want to kind of encourage people to not respond to RFPs. Sometimes, by the way, I found this to be a very useful approach. When I've gotten RFPs, I've often contacted the source and said, I'm not going to respond. I don't respond to RFPs. However, you are about to spend a lot of money and your RFP has a lot of problems. I will help you find a vendor. I will be your helper. I will help you rewrite the RFP. I'll help you develop a process for evaluating proposals and interviewing candidates, candidate companies, and evaluating them and so forth. And you know, you're gonna spend $250,000, whatever, spend $25,000 on me and you'll see that $250,000 investment go much better. So I'm not saying you shouldn't ignore them. There's opportunities there, but you should probably not respond to them as they have requested.
Samantha?
Yeah, I agree with that completely. I don't know that I've ever had a positive RFP response outcome. And I often look at an RFP as a sign that the organization has so many internal issues. It's already hard enough to do user experience work for organizations. That work is hard enough. But if you're working off of an RFP, you probably have enough organizational issues that it will be virtually impossible to do good UX work for that company. And then similarly, I try to avoid scenarios where I'm writing proposals. I have upfront conversations and then I try to write kind of scope of work. Mm-hmm. I'm only going to invest time and energy outlining a project if I'm, you know, kind of 70% certain that I am going to win the work or that I've in essence already won the work, unless I'm hungry. So I think it's also really important to keep in mind that you orient yourself differently at different times. You know, there is going into consulting because you have a burning passion to be a thought leader and you have something that you want to share as an advanced person moving into companies. That isn't actually why I went into consulting the most recently. I would say that is why I got associated with Argus. But I went into consulting most recently from a very pragmatic perspective of I needed to dial back my career so that I could put family first for a few years. And that was really frightening, but I could not work a 10-hour day for a period of time, or I wasn't willing to work a 10-hour day for a period of time. So in that time frame, I consulted for about 7 years. There were some times where I really had some good opportunities to go in and do thought leadership work that I was very proud of. But there were also times where I took work that was more of a contractor flavor or work that was really not stretching my abilities the way that I would have wanted perhaps in an ideal world, but it was keeping my foot in the door and it was paying the bills.
Great.
I'll take the internal perspective. I have a large, fairly large team, 50 UXers, and we assign most of those to software development projects, and they're on Scrum teams, and it's largely what I would think of as staff augmentation. Those roles are largely interaction designers and UI developers. Then we've got a few people who specialize in research projects. And most of that work is done on the basis of selling capabilities. So when we're negotiating for an opportunity or a need, it's on the basis of really looking at a team and looking at a fit in terms of skill set and things that they need providing that. It's somewhat self-evident and it's very qualitative. The other thing that we sell, if you will, internally are initiatives. And so these are the big ideas that we hook up. And so for example, we've done a major pattern library and component library on top of that, where the whole business case was based on reusability. Now, there's certainly a usability benefit there, but the economics of it, the cost-benefit analysis, were all based on reusability. And the sell for that was very, very quantitative. In those sorts of initiatives, even though the quantitative thing helps us sell it, what we really need to know within the organization is what's their appetite for doing or not doing the thing that we're thinking of. There's a great book by a guy named Gerald Weinberg. It's called The Secrets of Successful Consulting. He's got a whole series of books including a couple of books on consulting. He's a programmer, an expert in systems thinking. The systems thinking book is brilliant. And Weinberg's got a quote in one of his books where he says, you can take an elephant anywhere as long as they want to go there. And I think, you know, at least for these internal initiatives, as I think of them, that's very true. There's got to be an appetite for it. The job I had prior to the one I'm in now, I was at Sage Software, which is a UK-based company, and running a team, 15-person team in their CRM division. And we had, for our flagship product, which is a contact manager, we had about 200 users a year that I would rifle through iterative usability testing. Pretty robust program. We did a lot of it. We got the budget from marketing. Of course, UX has no budget. But we were really able to do something, I think, pretty impressive with that research program. We got a lot of quantitative data out of that, and, you know, white papers and everything. It was a great program. When I took the position at Optum and I moved over here, I tried to replicate that. And for a variety of cultural reasons, there was no appetite for it. So I've been banging my head against the wall for a few years on this, making some progress, and it's getting better. And I'm going to continue to fight the good fight. But the organizational culture doesn't have that same appetite. However, something I never planned on as a line of business for us, if you will, was UI development. And there's a strong appetite for UI developers. And you could argue, should that live in development management or should that live in UX? Well, we've chosen to take it on and we've built a little self-team. I've got half a dozen UI developers that we contract out. And just because there's an appetite and an opportunity, we follow that.
Great, we're gonna pivot a little bit here. Want to learn what the panelists think about tips for getting a client engagement off on the right foot. So 30 seconds or less. Samantha, what would you say is your top tips there?
Generally speaking, you know, at the very beginning of a project is when you really want to be at the top of your game. You want to make sure that you are learning as much as possible, as quickly as possible, about the culture in the environment, because that's going to have a big impact on how you're going to kind of orient yourself. I think it's really important to kind of figure out where the money is coming from, particularly in relationship to the person who brought you in.
Great. Dean?
Rapport. I think it's really important to build rapport, and often that means socializing. So I don't really necessarily have the time or the energy to work with people I would want to have a beer with or have lunch with. And so you need to break bread and have some social interaction with people in order to really build that working. Not in an ungenuine way, right? You don't want to be phony about it. You need to have those genuine opportunities and build rapport that way, but seek those out.
Go ahead.
You know, the beginning of any engagement is going to be very dependent on some sort of meeting, right? Some kickoff meeting, and then it's going to continue primarily through meetings. For that reason, I'm putting a plug in for one of our books. Kevin Hoffman, who's in the front row, is writing a book on meeting design for us. I also want to put in a plug for Game Storming, an O'Reilly book by Dave Gray and Sonny Brown and James Macanufo. And it's full of exercises that are game-like for running meetings in a hopefully a fun way. The couple that I really like, well, one I really use all the time, is the pre-mortem. It's a great exercise. Like, you know what a post-mortem is? Well, can you do a pre-mortem and make sure you get at what might go wrong before it does actually go wrong? So that's a great way to get meetings going. Another one that I wish was in that book, and I'll take credit for inventing this, is banning words. So one of the things that I find in a lot of meetings with clients is they come to me and say, you know, we want to do something with our redesign, or ask about portals. And there's a lot of words that our clients use that have absolutely zero meaning whatsoever. And yet they're cloaking their entire initiative behind these meaningless terms. It's not plain language, it's anti-plain language. It's jargon that they don't even understand. I'm not sure I know how to define any of those words. Can you define redesign or portal? I can't. So what I try to do is get at those words right away, identify them, and say, anyone who uses those words has to throw a dollar on the table, and if I do, it's $10. And it forces people to start using actual language so that you can get more successful at diagnosing the actual problems at hand.
I have one thing to add to that. I think that's a really good point. The other piece of kind of understanding your clients and their organizations is learning their language where possible. I can't tell you how many clients I have where customization and personalization mean the opposite for two different clients. So I will have to remember, you know, that for Eaton, customization means what I consider personalization to mean, but for this other client, it maps. in terms of just pick your battles. And a lot of times with terminology, kind of know the battles to pick and then the ones to just let it go. And when I started consulting, I used to always try to get people to go along with my definition. And I virtually never do that anymore, unless I feel like it's really impeding some kind of point that I'm trying to make.
Great, I'm gonna stop you here. I got one more question, and then we're gonna take questions from the audience. So think about what you wanna ask the panel here. What tips does the panel have for making sure you get paid in a timely fashion? Right, how do we get our money?
You're the money man.
Not really. I know that the standard advice that I try to follow when we can is to at least get a PO in advance or at least a partial payment up front. In my line of work, at least the clients I work with, it's not really been a huge problem. Often you do have to do some nagging, but I don't know. We haven't really had much of a problem getting paid. I don't know if that's because of the clients or just because of the basics of trying to get some money or at least a commitment through a PO up front. And the other thing I'd say is don't begin the work until you have an actual agreement in place. I'd love to do that stuff on a handshake basis, but unless we have a very strong relationship in place with the client already, it's just not gonna be worth your while. Most organizations are big enough that your client is not really the person who would sign. And at some point, when things go off the tracks, you don't wanna be in a position to say, hey, you know, you never signed this, and I'm starting to get worried about paying it. And then they just say, well, talk to my boss or talk to procurement. Do you really want to be talking to a procurement department? It's, you know, so you don't want to get wrapped into those or embedded into those horrible internal silos of dysfunction inside your client's organization. Get it in writing first.
Dean, I saw you had a thought there.
You know, I'll just reiterate. Okay. Nod my head at everything you just said.
Well, and I was going to add, you know, breaking amounts up into chunks and having them pay, you know, 25% either immediately following kind of the kickoff meeting or early, I think is a good way to kind of establish that. And then I will also add that my experience has been that the bigger the number, the easier and more likely that I'm gonna get paid without hassle. You know, the only cases where I have ever kind of been nickeled and dimed and had issues were for these little piddly things where I kind of felt like I was doing them a favor. So that's an interesting kind of conundrum, and I'm not the only person that has experienced.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a really good point because it ties back to the issue of charging more. When you charge more, you're typically dealing with a more senior person inside the organization. And they can get stuff done, and they can go stomp over to the procurement people and say, what the hell, and things like that. So, you know, again, raising your prices just makes so many other things that you didn't even think about all that much easier down the road.
Yeah. I would say one of the biggest issues I see for independents especially is they're afraid to ask for money up front. For some kind of down payment that they wait on an invoice and then they accept 60 or 90 day terms and suddenly they're worried about paying their bills, right? And so get some money up front. Don't be afraid to raise your rates. If they're gonna give you longer terms than you're comfortable with, charge them.
Can I do a very informal poll? How many of you have ever accepted terms of 60 days? How about 90 days? Okay. Did you regret that decision? It's tough. You're going to be hungry sometimes, but you still can't eat the PO.
With 90 days, it's a nice surprise.
Right. Oh, I forgot about that work. I will say that I do think that it's a good idea to be prepared for cash flow issues. And I did not expect to need a business line of credit. You know, the first couple of years, I never even used 1099s with people in terms of bringing in subcontractors. And yet I needed to use a line of credit my entire consulting career just to cope with the ebb and flow. You know, so I would make sure that I wasn't kind of spending borrowed money that I didn't have. But there's a lot of times where the time just isn't going to map out to when the money comes in the door.
Yeah, Weinberg says be a camel, right? You've got to have some reserves, and that's critical, particularly if you're solo.
Yeah, I think it's just important if you're a small business owner to have that plan for a rainy day. You know what you need and think about what if I don't have work for 3 months. Make sure you can handle that.
Can I also just, while we're on the subject of terms, just make a plea? Maybe this is like illegal, maybe this is cartelization, but you know, we got to kind of stand up here Many of us are finding that the world's largest corporations are telling us 60 days and even 90 days. And what they're doing, if you haven't really thought of it this way, it's really kind of chilling. They're making very small business people their bank. Could that be a more terrible thing to do? I mean, horrible for the economy, horrible for innovation that we're supposedly bringing this economy. And we're supposed to fund them. I would really, really, as hungry as you are, try to really hold the line there. Maybe go down on your rates a little bit, but try to force a 30-day as much as you can.
And Lou, let me just disagree a little bit with that. So sometimes it's just policy, right? We always do 60 days. And if you really want to do that work, figure out how to adjust your rates, right? If you would need to borrow money to get you by for that initial extra 30 days, it's only 30 days different maybe than what you would be comfortable with. What does that mean in terms of financial impact to you? Work it into the price, charge them back for it, and just know going in up front that I'm gonna have to wait a little bit longer, but I'm getting more money for that, right?
Yeah. The other thing you can do is launder money. Sometimes you can sell
You heard it here first.
So like our company and a lot of the big companies that I've worked for, we do have standard terms. We also have preferred vendors, right? So I'm not in a position right now to even be able to hire boutique vendors, but I can bring things kind of through, if I do it deftly, under other organizations, so you can subcontract, and then that subcontracting, or that contracting entity is the one that actually pays you, so you get paid, they're the ones waiting for the money, and you know I've done that before when I was selling.
Okay, this topic will be much better over beer, so I'm going to table this. Questions from the audience.
I had recently an organization I was working with, first time working with them, and I'm new to being out on my own as a consultant. And the contract, their standard contract that they gave me, it was net 30 days. Thought, okay, that's great. And then it had a clause in it about I don't get paid until they get paid from their client. And I looked at it and went, oh, no.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, but if I say something, that might kill the whole thing. And I'm hungry right now. I've got a gap. I've got to work. I thought, you know what? Damn it, I'm going to ask. I'm going to bring it up. And all I did was I put it in business terms of saying, hey, you know, I don't have any control over making sure you get paid, your payment process from your clients. So I'm really not comfortable with this clause. What can we do about that? And they sent me back an email saying, oh, thanks for catching that. Here's a new version of it without it.
Applause for that, because a lot of...
Moral of the story is you asked.
Yeah, so negotiate. And let me just add, I have had other companies that wanted to hire me present me with similar terms. And because they got majorly burned, where a client went bankrupt, they lost a bunch of money, they had to pay all their subs. The problem is, the client they're choosing to do work with, they have vetted. They have decided they're financially sound and contracted with them. They control their invoicing dates, you don't. So you're absolutely right. You should not accept those terms unless you really feel comfortable that you know the end client well enough that they're gonna pay and you're gonna get paid. So, good job. Next question.
Hi, I'm very happy to have your advice here. So my name's Kyle Susie. I've been an independent consultant for 11 years, and I struggle with this one issue where, as an independent consultant, it is just me. It is only natural that you are going to have highs and lows because it's flood or drought. It always is. And when you're in the flood, you cannot prospect because you need to sleep at some point. So my question is, what's the best way to keep in touch with clients like you've done great business with maybe 4 years ago and you haven't heard from them, or 2 years ago? How do you say, hey, I'm here, in that non-sleazy way? Because I'm very uncomfortable with being like, don't forget me.
What I like to do is send them something that I've recently read. So it's almost, you know, I'm constantly, even when I'm in a flood, I'm still paying attention to headlines and I'm seeing things that are happening. And, you know, sometimes it might be relatively peripheral, but a lot of times I see things that I think really actually are quite relevant. And that way I'm able to make contact with someone where I'm kind of offering them something that it may be a very nominal value, but it's not just, hey, I want you to remember I'm here. It's, I want to remind you that I'm here, and I'm the kind of person that is constantly adding value in our relationship.
That's great.
Fifth on the radar.
Another thought up here, Sonia?
Yeah. Can you give us an example?
Well, the most recent time that I did this actually wasn't in a consulting scenario, it was in a job hunting scenario. But I had had a first interview. In the context of the first interview, we had talked about some issues that the organization was facing. And within a week, I had seen several articles that were relevant. And this was an issue of they do enterprise internal facing software, and but they are beginning to have to think about their software from much more of a consumer-oriented perspective than they've ever had to. And so I came across a couple of articles that were related to that and was able to circle back, and instead of saying, you know, like, I'm just checking to see if you've made a decision of whether you're gonna, you know, interview me again, I was able to say, you know, I was reflecting on our conversation, saw this article, thought it might be of interest.
Yeah, great. We've got time for, I think, one more question over there on the wall.
Hi, I'm David Penarelli. Quick tip on getting paid quicker, sample size of one. This is just something that worked for me. I invoice clients using QuickBooks, and now they have a feature to allow online payment. And I said, I'm going to give this a shot. It has really modest fees associated with it, but I don't want to go so far as to say that when you change the interface of something, it changes people's behavior. But it seemed to me that when I could have my client pay via an ACH bank transfer, suddenly they were more comfortable doing that more quickly. And they didn't have to wait for, you know, the accounting department is going to cut checks on this day or those kinds of things. It really smoothed things because basically it makes paying you as easy as, you know, buying socks on Amazon.
That's great.
So just a tip.
I think we've got maybe a couple more minutes here. Let's take one more question. Over here in the middle.
Hi, folks. Thanks for the great panel. I'm wondering if you have any suggestions for somebody who's new to consulting. Let's say I were to tell you that I wanted to become a consultant and I'm starting from scratch and I know very little. What advice do you have for me? And what's the first thing that comes to mind when I ask you what advice do you have for me?
Great. Who wants to take that?
So figure out what your superpower is, right? So some niche, some specialization, some strength, some unique value proposition that you can provide, and even doubling down on that, right? Like really reinforcing that. That unique differentiation is critical to really providing value and building reputation.
I would say, you know, kind of be on the lookout everywhere for opportunities, and oftentimes, you can kickstart some of what you want to do by, I've had any number of conversations with people who are in nonprofits, people who are associated with churches. They're kind of telling me about a pain point. I realize that there's something that I can do to help them and then begin to parlay that. One of my great ones was that the public library interface just drove me insane, and so I did a quick mock-up to kind of show them why, you know, they had the button in the exact and just sent that to them. But that was able to then start a dialogue. So I think looking for opportunities to start small and to then kind of get that practice with that hustle factor.
Yeah, Lou?
I'll kind of come full circle and say, share that enthusiasm. You want to do it, and you're excited by it. And if you are public about that excitement, other people will catch it. And I think we often forget that, I don't know, some huge portion of consulting success has little to do with actual technical skill and a lot to do with, are you just someone other people want to be around? So if you can be like a fun, enthusiastic, interesting person who not only has something to offer but is willing to listen as well and be, in effect, in many cases, a therapist for your client, you're more an information therapist than an information architect. So, you know, that's important. And I think that carries the day, certainly when you're going up against another consultant who doesn't know those personality traits.
And I'll just add a piece of advice I got from someone when I was thinking about going out on my own. And I said, you know, what should I do? They had been independent for years. and they said, get clients. And I thought, what? And they said, everything else, you're smart enough, you'll figure it out. If you can get the work, you'll figure out the invoicing and the accounting and the taxes and, you know, all those things. You've got time to figure it out, but making sure you find good clients and good work is critical. So thank you everyone for attending. Please tweet out any takeaways you got from the session, and we'll see you in the break.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed this podcast from the 2015 IA Summit, subscribe and check out the full collection at library.iasummit.org and on iTunes. The 2015 IA Summit podcasts are brought to you by the UIE All You Can Learn Library. The All You Can Learn Library will give you the skills and techniques you need for a competitive design advantage with 24/7 access to experts and UX topics. For more information, visit aycl.uie.com. That's aycl.uie.com. As always, thanks for listening.